Right. Are we? We're all ready to go. Let me explain this first of all. The automaton is not autonomous, but that will happen. I'll explain that as I go along. The grammar, which has the capital G here, is because that is a precise use of the word grammar, and it is not our normal use of the word grammar at all. And that, I hope, will also become clear as we proceed. The reason I haven't stuck to the original title, The Autonomy of Language, can everybody hear me, by the way?
Yes.
Good. The Autonomy of Language is that autonomy of language turns out to be a fairly technical term used in language learning, and I don't want to confuse the issue. First of all, this here, a caveat. This is not a theory. I must emphasize that this is not a theory designed to explain the universe and everything. It's a way of seeing the relation between language and the world, or not even that. More a way of avoiding the kind of assumptions that lead us into philosophical dead ends. Because no one here, I'm sure, would deny that such dead ends do exist. Problems that are not just unresolved, but appear to be unresolvable. In fact, I believe a list of them earlier. Admittedly, such problems also provide careers for philosophy graduates, philosophy dons, and booksellers, and all sorts of people. But one of Wittgenstein's odd predilections was for finding a way out of such problems rather than digging himself in. I should also say that neither the word autonomy nor the word grammar should be taken at face value. Wittgenstein does not use the word grammar as we normally use it. He includes everything about language, including especially the lexicon, what you find in the dictionary, and the semantics, which grammarians usually leave out. And only if you accept that extraordinarily generous application of the word grammar can it be said to be autonomous. So the two concepts are interlinked. Like the grammar we're used to, however, his grammar is definitely rule-governed. I had a choice of three start points for this talk. In chronological order they are Frege's original problem with mathematics, for example, how do I infer from 2 plus 5 equals 7 that 2 volumes of liquid added to 5 volumes equals 7? In other words, how do I link the notation, the formal notation, the facts in the world? Secondly, de Saussure's course of lectures on synchronic linguistics at Geneva University, which had enormous implications and repercussions throughout continental philosophy. I'm not sure whether I should actually speak those words. And it concerns colour exclusion problems. So I'm going to start with number 3. Perversely, perhaps. This is the colour exclusion problem. This isn't the problem, this is the answer. It's 25 years, by the way, later than either of the other two. So if he was influenced by de Saussure or not, nobody knows. We don't know if he read him. De Saussure was published in French in 1915, but he was not widely read, I think, in England until translations in the late 30s, and that was well after de Saussure published this. Whether he was published in German or not, I honestly don't know. I should find out. Earlier in the Tractatus, Wittgenstein had taken the view that the proposition that a point in time and space is red contradicts the proposition that the same point at the same time is green. Call it PR contradicts PG. The revolution in his thinking, and it was no less than a revolution, happened, and may even have been brought about by, the realization that they are not contradictory, because each statement or attribution is complete in itself. It automatically, implicitly, entails the exclusion of any other colour attribution. They each take up the same logical space, which is not the same thing as physical space. The rule that PR cannot coexist with PG, the rule of mutual exclusion in what he would later come to call the language game, the color language thing, is therefore a rule about the use of color terms, a rule of grammar. Now that is an absolutely fundamental step in his thinking, and it's immediately hard to accept. So I'm going to move straight on and assume that you've accepted it. That rule is derived from our system of colour attribution, which is not necessarily a rule imposed by the natural world. Well, I put the word necessarily in there, he doesn't put it in there, and modern Wittgensteinians often don't put it in there either. But I think it's better if it says not necessarily a rule about the natural world, or imposed by the natural world. The rule is not, therefore, a proposition describing the world. It is not a fact that we can discover a posteriori, because we already know it. We know red is green. This relation of red to green is not a feature of the world, it is internal to the system, the pattern of use, the grammar. Like the rules that black is dark and white, that white is never transparent, and that nothing can flash black. These are, in his terms, rules of the grammar. So when I say that point is red, the complete colour system is applied immediately. Just as if I lay a ruler against a pencil and say the pencil is 6 inches long, then the whole system of length measure applies. The ruler is part of the system. The whole system is implied, is there when you lay the ruler down to measure something. Neither colour nor measure can be analysed any further, so people aren't colour and measure. All alternative attributions are excluded. That is what, in this case, alternative means. Incidentally, there is no, I'll leave that out. Such a view of the relation between language and the world is philosophically, though not linguistically, revolutionary. All the effort had gone into working out the relation from the other direction. Plato wished to carve nature at the joints. This is my next slide. Oh, here we are. Everything had gone into the other, come from the other direction. Plato wished to carve nature at the joints, as if we could all know at some point, one day, where the joints are. Not where somebody wants them to be, where it is convenient to cut them, where somebody has stipulated that they should be, whether it's engineer's joints or anatomist joints or butcher's joints, but that they were existing in, I presume, a metaphysical field of some kind, joints. The Wittgenstein, where the joints are, depends on who is making the decision, for what purpose, in which language way. This is a view he shares with Heidegger incidentally. Language, originally, in the Tractatus, and prior to the early 30s, was seen as a reflection of the world. In the Tractatus he calls it the great mirror. The world, reality, shall we say, in inverted commas, was and still is seen as determining language, and it was primarily a static world of objects and states of affairs. We even talk of mental states, and of course, mind can't actually exist if it stands still. So, philosophers ask questions about the real nature of objects, stuff, or abstract qualities, and God, and spirit, and justice, and mind. As if, by pronouncing the word in a sentence, you had it in your hand, as it were, and you could examine it and test it out. Probing for its essence. As if you had, by means of language, something other than words to examine. The word stands surrogate for the object. If there is a word, there must be an object behind it. The model for this was ostensive definitions. It's an Augustine story of how he learned language. His elders would point out something and say its name. Chair. Head. Pussycat. But, you say, for a child, that's not a pussycat, that's a puppy. And he sleeps on the floor. So what's a bed, you see? Is the floor a bed? Therein, says Wittgenstein's life effect, ostensive definition defines nothing. If I point to that chair, I might be indicating metal, blue, man-made, upholstery, belongs to the Rooney house. The pointing game depends on a deep background of understanding of the language already, and learning about concepts, nouns, categories, of what matters, or what they're talking about at the time, and so on. The object pointed to, like the patch on the colour chart, is just a sample being used within the language, and particularly within the training, the learning, that is part of language, part of the ground. Incidentally, the training and the learning part of it was something he brought in at a later stage, after he'd gone through the colour exclusion problem. If I say, look, you can see black, I have two halves, one black and one white, and I say, look, black is darker than white. You see, it's happening. That's it. That's the nature of black and the nature of white. And point to samples. He said that those samples are part of the grammar. They're part of the language. They're how we learn what is black and what is black. They are part of our understanding of our definition of black. Black is dark. So you see, Wittgenstein's grammar is not what most people would call autonomous at all. It's very much a part of living. But it is autonomous from the world's picture. It is not determined by how the world is, only how we deal with the world in a relatively arbitrary way. The word arbitrary I brought in here, which is quite important in both his philosophy and in De Saussure, whom I'm now going to talk about, is important, but it can lead us off at a tangent. So now I want to talk about De Saussure. Have I dealt with all those things? The fact, this thing that facts can justify grammar, well, by grammar there I'm talking about justify language. There are no facts about the world that can justify our ways of using language, he said. There are ways of using a language which are more or less useful in describing the world and in dealing with the world, but there are no facts that can justify it logically, because they belong to a different domain. Facts are propositions. Propositions describe facts. But rules of grammar would be what would be applied in writing a proposition, or using a proposition, describing a fact. Now let me talk now about De Saussure. De Saussure, as I said, his book appeared posthumously in 1913. It's the record of lectures he gave on linguistics. He'd been a professor in the history of languages, in the 19th century, and most study of languages historical, and Neil Valerian and Brothers Grimm, myself, were studied history, studied language diachronically, and were very important to see where words came from. His revolution was to emphasize the study of language as a synchronic system, that is, a system existing at one point in time. I'm going to read some extracts. The linguistic entity exists only by the association of a signifier with the signified. It vanishes once you lose either of these elements. Instead of a concrete object, you have only an abstraction. The chain of sounds is only linguistic if it is the support of an idea. By itself, it's only material for psychological study. Same is true of the signified, what we perhaps call the context. Once you separate it from its signifier, they only become linguist concepts, only become linguistic entities by association with their acoustic entities or images. Sorry. So that's a denial of, for example, clear and distinct ideas that are then interpreted into language, or of Fodor's idea of mental ease, a mental language, some proto something going on in the mind, which is then turned into language by some kind of mechanism. Just as they're explicitly denied that. This two-sided unity, it is a unity. The signified and the signifier are a unity. This has been distorted in structuralist philosophy and literary theory. A great deal of people have talked about a new signified for this signifier, or whatever, the other way around, which makes absolute nonsense of the original idea. Has often been compared with the unity of the human being composed of the soul and the body. This is a good analogy. One might also think of it as a chemical compound. Water, for example, by itself, neither of the elements has any of the properties of water. The machinery of language works entirely by means of identities and differences. We speak of the Paris-Geneva Express when we mean all the trains that leave for Geneva at 8:45. We mean the same train, though all the rolling stock is different. And it may even be 20 minutes late. It's still the 8:45 to Paris from Geneva. And we call the street the same even if it's been totally rebuilt, or even if it's in slightly different shape. Because it is founded on certain conditions unrelated to the material that forms it. For example, its relation to other items and its differences from them. Differences are words that come up over and over again, also used the word opposition. Wherever the same conditions are realized, you get the same entity. Moreover, these are not abstract, because a street or an express cannot be conceived of without some physical realization. Take, for example, and this is an example used by both Wittgenstein and Saussure, the knight in chess. Is it an element of the game in its own right? Assuredly not, because in its pure substance outside the game, it represents nothing to the player. It has no value. Suppose it gets lost or broken, can it be replaced with something else? Yes, of course. Not just with another knight, but even with something quite unlike, like a bottle top or a salt feather, which will acquire the same identity because it will have the same value. And Wittgenstein would say, obeys the same rules. Takes the same part of the same game, and the same rules apply to it. Like staying awake, for example, the terribly important rule we have immediately after lunch in Ruley House. You can also call it by a different name. A night doesn't have to be called a night, it can be called, as it is in fact, in Chester in Madagascar. And I don't know if it's true of all French language, it's called le fou. The fou. It doesn't make any difference, it's still the night. It plays the same role. So, in a semiological system like language, where elements are balanced against one another according to set rules, the notion of identity is assimilated to that of value. And he does it, take coins as another example. Taken by itself, and this is quite poetic, thought is like a mist with no part necessarily distinct from another. There are no determinate ideas, and nothing is clearly defined before the appearance of language. The characteristic role of language is not therefore to create a material, phonic means of expression for ideas, but to serve as an intermediary between thought and sound in conditions that necessarily produce in the end reciprocally defined units. That is again central idea in Wittgenstein. By the way, we are now talking about long in the security of language, which is distinct from parole, which is utter speech. It's a one stage idealized form of language. In modern terms, it's called competence and not performance. It's also comparable to a sheet of paper. Thought is on one side, sound is on the other. You can't cut one side without cutting the other. This combination produces a form, not a substance. And then he talks about the arbitrariness of the sign, but I think I will leave that out because it could send us off in the wrong direction. How is this value differentiated from what we call meaning? Value in its conceptual aspect is doubtless an element in meaning. Meaning, however, is only the counterpart of the acoustic image, within the limits of the word considered as a closed domain, existing for itself. This idea of the closed domain, this is where autonomy comes in. Wittgenstein later develops an idea called the Satzsystem, the system of propositions, which was a prototype of the language then, where individual systems could apply to different areas of life and activity. This is the paradox. On the other hand, the sign itself, what unites the two elements, is also just as much the counterpart of the other sign in the line. So, without the other signs, it is no longer what we call it. It is no longer the same sign. The knight is no longer what we could call a knight. If there's not another knight, a king, and so on, a queen. Values are always constituted by, first, something different, capable of being exchanged for something else whose value is thus determined. And second, similar things of comparable value. For example, in order to know the value of a 5-franc coin, one must know first that it can be exchanged for a specific quantity of something different, such as bread, and second, that it can be compared with a similar value from the same system, such as 5 1-franc coin. A word can, in a similar way, be compared with something different, an idea, and with something alike, another word. Its value is only truly determined by what surrounds it. In language, there are only differences. In language, as in all semiological systems, what distinguishes a sign is what constitutes it. Difference creates the character. The langue is a form, not a substance. It is a play, a jeu, to use the word jeu, of oppositions. Now, the word jeu in French, we use it for example, jeu de cartes, means both a game of cards and a stack of cards. And I think in what he says there, that he means both things. But it's very important to what I've just been talking about, Satzsystem, the word is a closed domain, language is a closed domain, that the set is limited. You have a limited number of members of the set, a limited number of possibilities at that point in the sentence, for example. And there are a limited number of prepositions, conjunctions that you can use. And it's very important they should be limited. And in Wittgenstein, he talks about language games, and of course he does extend that a great deal. He talks about playing games, but in his original, it's a Schachspiel. Now Schach, it's Sprachspiel. Sorry, Sprachspiel, which is the language game. Yeah. But that is very assonant with Schachspiel, which is a chess game. But Schachspiel also means a set in chess. So this likeness of the words for play, the game, and set, I think, are absolutely fundamental to their common vision. Now we also have the syntagmatic relation and the paradigmatic relation. Which is an important distinction. The syntagmatic relation is present, exists on terms equally present in series, such as the words of a sentence, and Frege says that a word only means something in the context of a sentence. A term acquires value only because it is opposed to what precedes it and what follows, or to both. This is something I think Frege would probably agree with. The paradigmatic relation, this is important, point is with what is absent. That is termed in a virtual memorized series. Like, for example, you come to a point in your sentence, you can't think of the right word, you go to the thesaurus, and you look for the whole list. That gives you a list of possibilities at that point in the sentence. Again, this is important to Wittgenstein as well, the idea of possibility. If we talk about possibility, we also need impossible. The rules say that you can only apply at this point in the sentence a certain category of words, a certain kind of word, a certain number of words, others are excluded. And it is extremely important, absolutely necessary for any communication system, that that number is limited. They are exact. You make a choice. You make a choice from a limited set, which is why the word language then becomes particularly relevant. The key ideas here are that the study of language is a symphonic system. The identity and inseparability in the sign of the signifying is signified only when joined to their identity. The identity, the value derived from a system of differences. Either in the paradigmatic dimension, the contrasting or opposed members of which are absent in the sentence. And lastly, he says, a collectivity is necessary to establish relative, that's my word, values whose only reason for being is in usage and general consent. And that, we will see, is very important to Wittgenstein. What is certain that is that by the 1930s, de Saussure's ideas about linguistics had revolutionized the study of language, also anthropology, and had a profound influence on literary studies during the last century, the latter half of the last century. There have been many distortions and even perversions of the idea of structuralism, but the fundamental view that phenomena can be examined as a system of differences, of oppositions, not related in any necessary way to an external reality, has been extraordinarily fruitful in most cases. Now, back to Wittgenstein. Here's a quote that may indicate some influence. We say that we use the command, in this case he used the word slab, in contrast with other sentences because our language contains the possibility of those other sentences. That could have been straight out of de Saussure. But there is another striking concordance. Note what de Saussure says about meaning. Meaning, however, is only the counterpart of the acoustic image within the limits of the word considered as a closed domain existing for itself. And here are some paragraphs from the investigations. It's come up a bit early. Never mind, you can digest it. When I have asked, this is Wittgenstein now, I'm quoting from this. When I have asked someone something and he gives me an answer, a sign, I'm content. That was what I expected. And I don't raise the objection that that's a mere answer. But how am I to know what he means when I see nothing but the signs he gives? But I say, how is he to know what he means? And he has nothing but the signs either. It says, I am not used to measuring temperatures on the Fahrenheit scale, so hence such a measure of temperature means nothing to me, says nothing to me. Suppose we ask someone, in what sense are these words a description of what you're seeing? He answers, I mean this by these words. So he's giving the answer. Why is this answer, I mean this? No answer at all. How does one use words to mean what one sees before one? Suppose I said A, B, C, D and meet had meant the weather is fine. As I uttered those signs, I had the experience normally had only by someone who had year in, year out used A, B, A in the sense of B and so on. Does A, B, C, D now mean the weather is fine? Make the following experiment. Say, it's cold here, and mean, it's warm. Can you do it? It's cold. And what are you doing as you do it? And is there only one way of doing it? So, this view of language, the idea of meaning as something behind the words, behind the sentences, meaning can be explained, it can be translated, you can say this means that in another language or another kind of phrase, it can be paraphrased, or demonstrated, so I can say pop means. But these are all part of the grammar of the language game of the limited rule-governed system of structure in fact. In other words, I say, I go, that's structure, that's language. What you see or hear is what you get. It's all on the surface. There is no mystery, nothing ineffable, nothing to be discovered to be found out about what lies behind what is written on the surface. You don't hear what is there, what is on the surface, what you see, if you're looking constantly at something behind it, you miss what is there. Actually, you look at that. Here are some examples of my own. A conductor will go. I can go, be quiet. Or I can say, shut up. Or, now go, you go. I think all of them have roughly the same meaning. They mean roughly the same thing. But there is no same thing that they mean. Can you see that? Good. Wonderful. Victory. Here is another situation. The mechanic who's under your car says, pass me a 5mm grommet. And you say, it's a grommet. Or, you could say, what does grommet mean? Or you could say, what do you mean by grommet? Actually, come back here to the triangle that is shown us earlier, the speaker over here, the word. All of those accept a similar answer, but each may lead to a different assumption about the underlying reality, the reality of the language of different words. Each has a potentially different metaphysical underpinning. The first may lead to a philosophical mistake. Now, I've also mentioned there the difference here between use and meaning. The second two uses there have inverted commas on them, because they are, as it were, quoted, or they are not mentioned, sorry. They are mentioned rather than used. The first one, however, assumes that we're using something other than the word, something else is in play than a simple word. What is a grommet? A grommet is, and then you look for the essence, you look for the true nature, the intrinsic nature of grommetness. Probably our definition, probably the description of grommets. The pictures of them, I expect, good manual, but it's a mistake to think that the meaning is an object. The meaning is what it means to you. And ultimately, Wittgenstein says, in the majority of cases, the meaning is the use. He doesn't allow proportion for the meaning of the use. Interestingly enough, this is seen as a highly debatable answer, meaning is used. But if you ask somebody what something means and they don't know what it means, where do they go for it? Well, they go to the dictionary. What does the dictionary tell us? What information does the dictionary have on it?
Consensus.
Consensus. How is a dictionary made? It's made by hundreds of people sending in examples of the use of a word. Those usages on little strips of paper are then collated by the dictionary compilers, and they try to synthesize all those uses. If you look at the AED, the OED, if you look at a good dictionary, you will see that it's about use or using. With a bad dictionary, like the one people use for Scrabble, it's the same thing, it appears to be definition. But there's no great definer in the sky out there, defining what words mean. Dictionaries are derived purely from use and that. And most of us see it anyway. Meaning comes from centered structure, from the choice of an item among those possible. Thinker estimates an average of 10 possibilities in each phase of the sentence. That's an average. That is the paradigmatic relation from association. The meaning also comes from association, that's connotation, from experience of usage, from use or function in this context, and not necessarily in that order. Any one of those criteria may be more important than another. Meaning is what the utterance or the utterer is doing. It's also what the hearer or the reader understands, which in the case of special writing can widely, will vary widely over audiences and time. And there's a lot of the writing in French literary theory and philosophy is about that. In Borges, you see that. So. Meaning lies on the surface. It is the surface. It is more obvious with semiotics. A pinstripe suit, for example, by wearing a pinstripe suit, that would be a significant choice, would have meaning, but no meaning lies behind it. It could be translated into other terms, and somebody might hypothesize what I was trying to say, or what kind of impression I was trying to give, but a pinstripe suit is the meaning. It's its own signifier and signifier, constituted by all the other choices possible, the range of things I might have been wearing or not wearing. Regimental ties and flags, on the other hand, contain symbols and signs which are used to signify. They are a similar system. But let's take the case of bunting. You know, there's little flags, the pennants that you stick up, and they're in certain places. They have a meaning. Can anybody give a meaning of bunting? Bunting is its own signifier. There are places where you expect to see bunting, other places where you don't expect to see it. And bunting both signifies, it is both content and form. There's a significance in its presence or its absence. We understand it because we know the sort of places where it's expect to see it. We can try to explain what it is about those places which are signaled by bunting. For a foreigner, perhaps, we can't translate it. But that is part of its grammar, the structure or the use of bunting, not the meaning of bunting. Back to our title, The Autonomy of Grammar. I say that grammar, it is not grammar as we know it, neither is it autonomous. The two are connected. There are limits to autonomy. This is all about use, already dealt with. It should be clear by now that his word, use of the word grammar includes far more of language than the normal usage or Chomsky use. He's actually much more concerned with the lexicon in grammarian's language than semantics. Language is a form of life and intimately bound up with living. His lifelong obsession with language began with a project very much like that of Frege and Russell, an attempt to bind language to the world, to distinguish the truth relation from any other. He invented truth. But then his continual wrestling with this problem led him to the realization that language is a system, and many statements, apparently about the world, are actually a priori statements that define merely the system they are part of. They are relational to each other and to the system. They are not dictated by the world's nature and structure and do not necessarily specify the joint which nature is discussed. Whether this insight comes either directly or indirectly from dissociative evidence. it's a philosophical autonomy, not any other kind. It's autonomous in philosophical terms, within the world of philosophy. At the beginning, I mentioned Frege's problem. Oh, sorry. But once detached, language has to be reattached. Obviously, it can't float free of our world of affirming. So it should float free of our worldly concerns. The result is that language turns out to be far more intimately connected with our lives than is imagined by Frege, Russell, or the logical positivists. It incorporates our learning, our training, our needs, our customs, our uses and usage. It's part of everything we do and have done. At the beginning, I mentioned Frege's problem. Frege's problem, if you remember, was it is not autonomous to the extent that the language has to work in the world. So it's not arbitrary to that extent, or you can't say anything about any language use. The truth. Changes in knowledge can change the criteria for use in so many meanings. Grammar is autonomous because grammar is inclusive. You can see, perhaps, from what I've said, how much it includes. It is not just how we understand, but what we understand. Very good. That was his problem. Well, now, let's try and answer that problem. Let's imagine somebody in a primitive society who keeps their water in gourds, for example, and bowls, and somebody says to them, if you put that gourd and that gourd, you know, add them together, pour them together, how much water will you have? Interesting. It's assuming at this point that the idea of how much has some kind of meaning. Why not? Let's skate over. How does she do it? Well, if she's clever, she will take the smaller of the two gourds, divide it into two, put it into two bowls so that they're that equal. Maybe she's got a balance. And she will then have a quantity that she can call half the smaller gourd. They make a mark on the bowl. She now has a unit, she has a criterion for measurement. Right, now she pulls them back into small gourds, and then she takes up the big gourd to see how many of those units she has. 8 plus 3 is 5. She counts it up and 2 plus 5. That's actually a number that we call my wedding ring finger. In my language. So she's done the job. She's done what Frege wanted her to do. And the point is, Wittgenstein's point here would be, my example of his, it's embedded in the practice. That what makes the maths apply to the world is the practice. Practicing, the usage, the learning, the training, the drill, getting on with it. The application comes from application. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Peter. We ostensibly have questions here, which are not questions, can we maybe just start off, if people have a question for Peter on what he was saying, and we'll spend 5 or 10 minutes on that, and then we'll gather together to have a discussion. And can we try and do that to start with? Questions.
Thank you.
find it.
My goodness, I'm amazed.
It's just really unpacking the one or two things here. You say language is not a reflection of reality, it's a collection of self-contained systems of time.
I said it is not imposed by reality. And it is not necessarily a reflection of reality. It may turn out that it is, but it's, and if it's to be maximally useful, of course it will be.
Right. Now, so it's point five in four on your handout. You say the thing pointed to is the thing itself. It's the sample for use in the grammar. Now, are you saying that that is wrong?
Sorry, what did I say there? Let's go back. It's about the Augustinian essential definition thing, isn't it? Oh right, I see point 5 and 4, yes. No, there's something there. Yes, the thing pointed to is it should be, is
Now that first sentence is wrong. I'm sorry, it is confusing. It is a sample for use. In me, that vital point of connection between China and the world. Well, what the book is saying is that is not the time. It's certainly kind of the point to me. That's the thing. What I would say is to do that, but eventually. This is part of the way we learn language. Part of the way. But what's pointing to occur, so to say, means a huge amount of background knowledge in order to understand what it means. The person has got what the meaning pointing to about it, so I will have to think. Only partly that. It's one of the practice things in use. And if I need to explain to somebody what a chair is, because I can say, I think that the writing that has been about this reinterpretation over time has been by people who themselves are rather difficult to understand the question. But it is nevertheless true. I mean, they talk about the reader remaking the world, the reinterpreting, and both of them are perhaps the best one for that, which is something self-theory. Talks about Shakespeare, the 20th century Shakespeare is not the Shakespeare of the 17th century. It's quite a different person, quite a different understanding. The audience is reacting in a completely different way. He reads that in extreme terms, but that's what it amounts to. The language is not a constant, I mean, it's a constant informal term in terms of what's written on the paper, but this is not
that constant in the part of faith in the people's life. First of all. Example that community out there, I think, went to see the first night of the Ugandan Russian. It was absolutely brilliant. And it's too late now, it's too tough. But it was a brilliant play, didn't it? But there's a moment in there where Malvolio is whisked away by the princes, and they say, he's a wise woman to look at his water. And that is a direct reference to conventional understanding about witchcraft. Why do you mean that he's a witch? And looking at his water would be a way of diagnosing his mental illness. He's what? Fullness. Practice. And cultural behavior. So that the word that can only be understood within that sphere of activity.
I don't know point six where you talked about your music group, what you're interested in, what you get. But I don't understand how that's the kind of thing that you're trying to do with the same stuff that you do the
other. Oh, well, if you see irony, that's what you get. There's not a problem there. Irony is in context, I think. When people understand this theory along the same, and also that things are not just along the same, I would say sex and stuff is a problem with the same thing personally, and even some non-specialists say this. Certainly, the language of philosophy is a non-specialist.
So to understand irony, you need to not to understand the story of the reverse of it, and you need to some...
Of course, yeah.
Un-ironic.
Yeah.
So what you see is what you get with.
Well, what you see is that you're not getting what you see, okay? You see what I mean? All sorts of, yeah. Yeah, I mean, clearly, what he's saying is what I'm saying, that he didn't use that thing. He was even with a computer, IT. But he's saying it's not behind them. You're not looking for a reality behind them. It's there on the surface. And the language we are using is adequate for the purpose, which is what he said. It's not, I have to say, absolutely true, because in, for example, philosophy, and many of the downstairs, and psychology, and so forth, distinctions are made within the expression of difficulty, which you wouldn't use in ordinary language. And I spoke to Huffner a couple of years ago, perhaps there is no such thing as a new language. And he said, why would you want to say that? But I think that all the times of all places we are using relatively secularized language, there is no standard, certainly of English, that is recognizable as one register for all the world.
No, I understand that, because the language is more complex than
what I'm denying is not the important thing.
Maybe
you.
I'm trying to think of what is going on in the language, in the confused about the word, but it's example, it's a really trying to fix that to the word from and not quite what I can say.
Ah, well, I think that's deal with that. I think that's going to say at the point where a new discovery is made, as in the case of S plus phosphorus and Venus, so you can say, actually, quite interesting. Somebody said to him once, in the same question came up, somebody said to him, but you have to admit it does look as though the sun goes round the earth. And he said, how would it look? Didn't. This is the whole point. If you stick to your view like that, once you allow yourself to think that way. Now, he accounts for it by saying that we can change the meaning of our vocabulary to vocabulary by applying new criteria in the light of new discoveries. It's not a problem.
I'm not sure what the question is.
They don't, discoveries in the sense I think you're talking about are made by scientists, and the information from scientists is sometimes taken up by philosophers, sometimes misunderstood by philosophers, etc. It's a different, a discovery is not a subject for philosophy on the whole. Is it? No, no?
Yeah.
Yes, I wasn't sure if you had your hand up or not.
Yeah.
Shall we just try and break now into the sort of more group discussion?